This is part three of the April, May, June 2022 Criminal Law Update CLE. We are now in the June Criminal Law Reversal Report. First case is People v. Smith on page 7. The issue is whether there was sufficient evidence that the defendant shared the intent of the people who actually robbed the victim. The Third Department, reversing the defendant's robbery convictions, held the evidence that defendant shared the attacker's intent to rob the victim was legally insufficient. Defendant had set up a drug purchase from the victim. When the victim arrived at the location that was set up, he was attacked and robbed by four masked men. Although the victim testified defendant was one of the masked men, there was strong evidence to the contrary. The court wrote, "The people didn't have any direct evidence demonstrating that defendant knew of or shared an intent to forcibly steal property from the victim. There was no evidence that defendant had prior knowledge of a plan to rob the victim." So the takeaway here, although the defendant did send the victim to the address where the victim was to sell marijuana to a buyer, there was no evidence defendant was aware the buyer intended to attack and rob the victim. There was no evidence defendant shared the robber's intent, and his robbery convictions under an accomplice liability theory were reversed. Next is People v. Bunton on page 8. Here the evidence of physical injury, which is an element of the assault second charge, was not proven by legally sufficient evidence. The case demonstrates how high the bar is for proof of physical injury in the context of an assault. The Fourth Department, reversing defendant's assault second conviction, held the evidence the police officer sustained physical injury within the meaning of the assault statute was legally insufficient. The court wrote, "Physical injury means impairment of physical condition or substantial pain." That's Penal Law Section 10, Subdivision 9. Although pain is subjective, the Court of Appeals has cautioned that the legislature did not intend a wholly subjective criterion to govern. Factors relevant to an assessment of substantial pain include the nature of the injury viewed objectively, the victim's subjective description of the injury and his or her pain, whether the victim sought medical treatment, and the motive of the offender. Here the officer testified that he experienced quite a bit of pain to his left upper thigh groin area after struggling with defendant when he resisted arrest, and that his pain was a 6 or 7 out of 10 on the pain scale. There was only a vague description of the injury, and no medical records for the officer were introduced in evidence. There was no testimony the officer took any pain medication, and the officer did not miss any work or testify that he was unable to perform any activities because of the pain. So the takeaway here, there was only a vague description of pain, and no medical records were introduced. So the assault conviction was not supported by legally sufficient evidence the police officer suffered physical injury, something more than just the victim's subjective description of the pain must be placed in evidence. At this point, I'm going to insert the second verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this April, May, June 2022 Criminal Law Update CLE. The second verification code is fingerprint. Again, the second verification code for this April, May, June 2022 Criminal Law Update CLE is fingerprint. Next, People v. Jones on page 9. This was a burglary case. The conviction was reversed, this time because the conviction was found to be against the weight of the evidence. And this is to be distinguished from reversals based on finding that the evidence was legally insufficient. if evidence is legally insufficient, the trial order of dismissal motion should have been granted. The case should never have gone to the jury. Where the court finds the conviction was against the weight of the evidence, in my opinion, that means that there was sufficient evidence to go to the jury, but the appellate court simply disagrees with the jury's interpretation of the evidence, and the appellate court acts like a second jury. Fourth Department, reversing defendant's burglary conviction, held the evidence that a partial fingerprint from the burglary scene matched the defendant was too weak to support the conviction, and the conviction was against the weight of the evidence. The court wrote, on cross-examination, the fingerprint examiner agreed that her opinion is subjective, that two examiners may reach different opinions when examining the same set of prints, and that verification by a second examiner, particularly blind verification, significantly increases the accuracy of fingerprint analysis. She testified that every individual fingerprint has approximately 80 to 120 classifiable characteristics, and that every characteristic between two prints must be identical for them to be considered a match. Because of the limited nature of the partial print, she was only able to match 18 characteristics, meaning that it matched 15 to 22% of the characteristics of defendant's inked print. There was no evidence presented at trial that a second examiner had made a positive verification that the partial print was made by the defendant. No other evidence was introduced at trial linking defendant to the crime. So the takeaway here, a partial fingerprint matched only 15 to 22.5% of the characteristics of defendant's inked print, and the match was not verified by a second examiner conducting a blind verification. There was no other evidence linking the defendant to the burglary, so the conviction was deemed against the weight of the evidence. Next is People v. King, pages 10 and 11. And it demonstrates the high bar for proving constructive possession of contraband. Here, it was a firearm. Fourth Department, reversing defendant's conviction over a dissent, held the proof that defendant constructively possessed a firearm was legally insufficient. The firearm was in the top drop ceiling of a living room where the defendant was present as a guest. DNA evidence may have demonstrated defendant possessed the firearm at some point in time, but it didn't demonstrate constructive possession at the time the firearm was seized. The court wrote, a defendant's mere presence in the house where the weapon is found is insufficient to establish constructive possession, and it is undisputed that defendant had no connection to the apartment other than being there for a brief period of time to gamble. The people failed to establish defendant exercised dominion or control over the handgun by a sufficient level of control over the area in which it was found. Defendant's text messages did not evince defendant's consciousness of guilt, and in any event, mere knowledge of the presence of the handgun would not establish constructive possession. Although evidence that defendant's DNA profile matched that of the major contributor to the DNA found on the handgun, and that other individuals in the apartment were excluded as contributors, would support an inference that defendant physically possessed the gun at some point in time. We conclude that it was not sufficient to support an inference defendant had constructive possession of the weapon at the time it was discovered. So the takeaway here, the DNA evidence suggested the defendant possessed the firearm at some point, but defendant's presence as a guest in the room where the firearm was found was not sufficient evidence of constructive possession of the firearm. In order to demonstrate constructive possession, there must have been proof that the defendant exercised dominion and control over the area where the gun was found, so the conviction was reversed. Next is People v. Ocampo, pages 11 and 12. The question here was whether the judge improperly delegated his authority to the court clerk in asking questions of prospective jurors. The First Department held the judge didn't improperly delegate judicial authority to the court clerk, who made a preliminary inquiry of a group of prospective jurors. The court wrote, defendant was charged with committing sex crimes against his girlfriend's 6-year-old daughter. The evidence included 2 videos taken with defendant's phone showing defendant having sex with the child. On the first day of jury selection, to identify and dismiss prospective jurors who could not be fair and impartial in light of the nature of the charges and the graphic evidence, the court addressed the approximately 200 prospective jurors in groups of approximately 50. The court told each group about the charges and described the video evidence. All the panelists who stated they couldn't be fair and impartial were excused. When the jury selection continued 2 days later, 92 panelists remained. Because of the size of the group, they were placed in an assembly room down the hall from the courtroom and in the next courtroom. The court informed the parties that some of the remaining panelists had approached court officers stating that they had thought about it and now believed they could not serve as jurors. The court proposed sending the court clerk to each of the rooms where the jurors were waiting to ask generally the question that whether they had thought about it and could no longer serve. Any prospective jurors who answered in the affirmative would be brought into the courtroom for further questioning by the court. Defense counsel consented to the procedure. When the clerk returned to the courtroom, the clerk reported that there were 10 prospective jurors who had an issue. The 10 panelists were brought to the courtroom where the court inquired whether, based on the nature of the case and the kind of evidence you will be seeing during the course of the trial, the panelists now thought they could not be fair and impartial. So the takeaway here, defense counsel consented to the court clerk's asking prospective jurors whether they could serve in this sexual assault of a child case. The inquiry was not an improper delegation of judicial authority. There was no mode of proceedings error, which would have required reversal on appeal, even though the issue wasn't preserved. I think the key issue here was the court never delegated its authority to inquire directly of the prospective jurors whether they could serve in this sexual assault of a child case. Next is People v. Laboriel, pages 12 and 13, a Court of Appeals case where the Court of Appeals is explaining the scope of their review powers, here dealing with a sentence and a guilty plea. The Court of Appeals, over an extensive 2-judge dissenting opinion, held 1. The validity of a guilty plea is not properly raised in the Court of Appeals after the appellate division has affirmed the defendant's legal sentence. And 2, where a sentence is legal, an excessive sentence claim is beyond the scope of the Court of Appeals. The court wrote, defendant's challenge to the validity of his plea is not properly raised on this appeal from an appellate division order affirming a sentence, and that's pursuant to 22 NYCRR section 670.11, Subdivision B. Defendant's sentence, an authorized prison term with post-release supervision, is not illegal, and any excessive sentence claim is beyond the scope of this court's review. So the takeaway here, the affirmance of a legal sentence by the appellate division does not give the Court of Appeals the authority to review the validity of the guilty plea. And second, if a sentence is legal, an excessive sentence claim is beyond the scope of the Court of Appeals. Next is People v. Bovio, page 13 and 14. It deals with the effect of a plea colloquy in which an element of the offense is negated. The Fourth Department, vacating defendant's plea to depraved indifference murder, held that the plea colloquy negated an essential element of that crime. The court wrote, we agree with defendant that although his admissions during the plea allocution established the mens rea element of recklessness, His recitation of the facts underlying the charge of murder in the second degree cast significant doubt upon his guilt insofar as it negated the second mens rea element of depraved indifference. In response to the court's question whether defendant did not care if harm happened to the victim or how the risk to the victim turned out, defendant stated through defense counsel that he did care for the victim. We conclude that defendant's statement negated the element of depraved indifference because the second mens rea element of the crime required that defendant did not care whether the victim lived or died, or in other words, that he did not care how the risk turned out. Defendant conveyed during the factual recitation the exact opposite of the requisite mental state, that is, that he did in fact care for the victim. So the takeaway here, the defendant during the plea colloquy for depraved indifference murder stated through his counsel that he cared for the three-year-old victim. That statement negated the element of depraved indifference murder, which requires the defendant not care if the victim lives or dies. So the plea was vacated. Next is People v. Williams, pages 14 and 15. It's another depraved indifference case. This time the defendant's conviction was reversed after trial. The court found that the conviction was against the weight of the evidence. The third department reducing defendant's conviction from depraved indifference murder to manslaughter over a dissent held that the intoxicated defendant's driving when fleeing from the police did not evince a complete disregard for the safety of others. Therefore, the depraved indifference murder conviction was against the weight of the evidence. The court wrote, "The credible evidence at trial made clear defendant was extremely intoxicated, but his driving prior to the police pursuit demonstrated that he was aware of his surroundings, obeyed multiple traffic signals, and responded to the alerts of other drivers. Although he was driving at an exceptionally high rate of speed during the pursuit, he did so on a roadway designed to accommodate greater rates of speed, and there was no evidence that he failed to abide by any traffic signals while he fled or that any vehicles were forced to pull over or move out of the way. Defendant did partially enter the lane of oncoming traffic for brief periods, but such episodic conduct stands in stark contrast to cases where the defendant traveled in an oncoming lane as part of a deadly game. Defendant largely chose to evade police not by weaving in and out of the oncoming lane, but instead by driving on a wide paved shoulder, and even if his attempted escape was carried out in a reckless manner, he may simultaneously intend to flee police and avoid striking other cars. No contact occurred between defendant's vehicle and any other vehicle before the accident, and the limited evidence of his proximity to other vehicles prior to the collision falls short of establishing the sort of narrow misses, the disregard of which could be some evidence of depraved indifference." So the takeaway here, the intoxicated defendant acted recklessly in fleeing from the police, but his driving did not evince a depraved indifference to the safety of other drivers. For the most part, defendant followed the rules of the road and avoided other vehicles. The depraved indifference murder conviction was not supported by the weight of the evidence, and the conviction was reduced to manslaughter. Next is People v. Dancy on pages 15 and 16. It deals with the sentencing requirements where the installation of an ignition interlock device is part of the sentence. That device detects whether the driver has consumed alcohol and won't allow the car to start if it detects the alcohol. The Second Department, reversing county court, held defendant could not be directed to install an ignition interlock device where there was no sentence to probation or to a conditional discharge. The matter was remitted for resentencing. The court wrote, "Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1193 provides that the court shall sentence such person convicted of a violation of Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1192 to a term of probation or conditional discharge as a condition of which it shall order such person to install and maintain an ignition interlock device. In directing the defendant to install a functioning ignition interlock device, the county court failed to impose a sentence of probation or conditional discharge, and therefore failed to comply with the requirements of the statute. So the takeaway here, the vehicle and traffic law requires that the direction to install an ignition interlock device be part of a sentence to a period of probation or a conditional discharge. Next is People versus Weinstein, or Weinstein, on pages 16 and 17. This is the criminal action against the famous movie producer, Harvey Weinstein. It's a long and factually dense decision. It's actually an opinion. First Department affirming Harvey Weinstein's criminal sexual act and rape convictions held the expert testimony about rape trauma was admissible. The Molyneux evidence was properly admitted on the issue of intent, and the Sandoval ruling was proper. With respect to the rape trauma syndrome, the court said, "We find that the trial court properly permitted the doctor to testify. Defendant has presented us with no authority suggesting that rape trauma syndrome has been discredited as a scientific phenomenon. And because the syndrome is shrouded by certain rape myths, we can think of no more appropriate area where a jury requires the elucidation that can be facilitated by an expert witness. In other words, where there was a risk that the jury would be puzzled by some of the behaviors of the complainants during and after their sexual encounters with defendant, it was appropriate to admit evidence of psychological syndromes that would eliminate that confusion. Defendant made clear that his defense would be based on those behaviors, which he would argue to the jury were inconsistent with how a victim of a sexual assault would behave." And turning to the Molyneux evidence, the court said, "From the people's perspective, there was a significant risk the jury would have concluded defendant did not intend to compel the women to have sex with him. By introducing the Molyneux evidence, the people were able to counter defendant's narrative by showing that the offenses against the three victims were simply more elaborate manifestations of his practice of baiting women with opportunities for career advancement and then taking advantage, all the while being completely uninterested in whether the women welcomed his advances and determined to go forward whether they did or not." And with regard to the Sandoval issue, the court said, "The amount of Sandoval material is unquestionably large and at first blush appears to be troublingly so. Nevertheless, in considering the propriety of whether to admit Sandoval material and how much, the Court of Appeals has stated that the determination rests largely within the reviewable discretion of the trial court to be exercised in light of the facts and circumstances of the particular case. We acknowledge the sheer size of the impeachment material that the court allowed. We have analyzed that decision within the larger context of all the circumstances presented by this case and concluded the court providently exercised its discretion." So the takeaway here, the First Department found that expert testimony about rape trauma syndrome, extensive Molyneux evidence, and extensive Sandoval evidence were properly admitted here in the Harvey Weinstein trial. Next is People versus Felli, F-E-L-L-I, pages 17 and 18. It's a unique issue. Here the trial court initially dismissed a count of the indictment. The dismissed charge was promoting prison contraband. The people then appealed that dismissal. The court decided to stay the dismissal and go ahead with the trial, and the defendant was convicted of promotion of prison contraband after the trial. The Third Department, vacating defendant's promoting prison contraband conviction, held that the trial judge, who initially dismissed the promoting prison contraband count should not have subsequently stayed the dismissal and gone to trial on that count along with the other charges. Apparently, the judge stayed the dismissal of the charge because the people had appealed the dismissal. After the trial, the people's appeal was dismissed as moot, and then the defendant appealed and argued the judge did not have the authority to stay the dismissal and go to trial on the dismissed count. The court wrote, "We agree with defendant that county court improperly stayed its dismissal order after the people appealed the dismissal." The court went on, "There was no statutory authorization for a stay of county court's dismissal order. Without a stay, the bench trial should not have included the charge of promoting prison contraband, and there should have been no occasion for defendant to be convicted of a lesser included offense of that charge. We vacate that conviction." So the takeaway here, with certain exceptions in the criminal procedure law, section 460.40, the dismissal of a count cannot be stayed when the people appeal the dismissal. Here the judge dismissed a count, the people appealed, the judge then stayed the dismissal, held a trial, and defendant was convicted of that count, and then the people's appeal was dismissed as moot. Because the judge had no authority, pursuant to criminal procedure law 460.40, to stay the dismissal and go to trial on the dismissed count, the conviction was vacated. Next is People v. Davis on page 19. It's an ineffective assistance case. The defendant said his attorney told him he had a chance of being convicted of the charge, which was attempted gang assault, and therefore he pled guilty to that charge. But attempted gang assault is a legal impossibility for trial purposes. The Fourth Department held there should be a hearing on whether defendant's plea to attempted gang assault was involuntary. Defendant contended the plea was based on inaccurate advice from his lawyer. Attempted gang assault, that's the charge to which the defendant pled guilty, is a legal impossibility for trial purposes. The court wrote, "We agree with defendant that attempted gang assault in the second degree is a legal impossibility for trial purposes, as there can be no attempt to commit a crime which makes the causing of a certain result criminal, even though wholly unintended. Based on that law and our review of the record, we agree with defendant that the advice of defense counsel regarding the possibility of a conviction at trial of attempted gang assault in the second degree was erroneous. Nevertheless, it's well settled that permission to withdraw a guilty plea rests largely within the court's discretion. Whether a plea was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary is dependent upon a number of factors, including the nature and terms of the agreement, the reasonableness of the bargain, and the age and experience of the accused. That the defendant allegedly received inaccurate information regarding the possibility of a conviction at trial and the resulting impact upon his possible sentence exposure is another factor which must be considered by the court, but it is not in and of itself dispositive. Where the record raises a legitimate question as to the voluntariness of the plea, an evidentiary hearing is required." So the takeaway here, attempted gang assault is a legal impossibility at trial, and here the defendant was entitled to a hearing on whether his plea to attempted gang assault was involuntary because of counsel's inaccurate advice about the possibility of conviction at trial. But the court made it clear that the fact that the defendant received inaccurate advice is not dispositive of whether his plea was voluntary or not, and a hearing was required. Next is People v. Williams, pages 20 and 21. It's another ineffective assistance case. The Fourth Department, reversing county court, held that defendant's motion to vacate his conviction on ineffective assistance grounds should have been granted. Defense counsel didn't interview a witness who, based on the witness's testimony at the hearing on the motion to vacate, would have testified defendant was not at the scene of the shooting. The court wrote, "We conclude that defendant met his burden of establishing that defense counsel's failure to interview the potentially exculpatory witness constituted ineffective assistance of counsel, inasmuch as the record before us reflects the absence of strategic or other legitimate explanations for defense counsel's deficient conduct. The failure by defendant's trial counsel to interview the witness cannot be characterized as a legitimate strategic decision because without collecting that information, defense counsel could not make an informed decision as to whether the witness's evidence might be helpful at trial. To the extent that the defense team deemed the witness not credible due to his criminal record or history, that alone does not excuse trial counsel's failure to investigate, since a witness's unsavory background does not render his or her testimony incredible as a matter of law. We conclude that even if the witness's criminal record provided a strategic basis for choosing not to present his testimony, it does not provide an excuse for defense counsel's failure to investigate him as a possible witness. The witness's testimony at the Criminal Procedure Law Article 440 hearing was wholly consistent with the theory pursued by trial counsel, namely that defendant was not present at the shooting and that the crime was instead committed by an individual seeking to rob the victim's residence, and the proposed witness would have provided the only eyewitness testimony at trial as to the shooting. So the takeaway here, defense counsel was made aware of a potentially exculpatory witness and did not interview him. The fact that defense counsel felt the witness was not credible did not excuse the failure to investigate. Defendant's motion to vacate his conviction on ineffective assistance grounds was granted by the appellate court. Next is People v. Michalski on page 21. This case stands for the simple proposition that you can't waive an indictment and plead guilty to a superior court information if you've already been indicted. Third Department reversed defendant's judgment by guilty plea, dismissed the superior court information. A defendant cannot be prosecuted by a superior court information after indictment, and here the defendant had already been indicted. The error is jurisdictional and need not be preserved by an objection, and the issue is not forfeited by a guilty plea. The court wrote, "As the Court of Appeals has observed, given the objective and the plain language of Criminal Procedure Law 195.10, the conclusion is inescapable that waiver cannot be accomplished after indictment, even where it is the defendant who orchestrates the scenario. Here, at the point in time when defendant agreed to be prosecuted by a superior court information, defendant already had been indicted and the matter was scheduled for trial. Although the indictment subsequently was dismissed, there's no indication in the record that the dismissal was occasioned by a defect in the indictment itself, or that Supreme Court authorized resubmission of the charge to the grand jury, and it doesn't appear that a new felony complaint was filed. Therefore, defendant was not placed on a formal pre-indictment procedural track. Under these circumstances, the waiver of the indictment is invalid, and the resulting Superior Court information must be dismissed." So the simple takeaway, the defendant was already indicted when he waived indictment and he pled guilty to a Superior Court information that was a jurisdictional error which need not be preserved by an objection. Next is People v. Rochia. It's on page 22. It's a conflict of interest case. The defendant brought a motion to vacate his conviction, but before the judge whose law clerk was the district attorney in charge of prosecuting the defendant for the underlying offense. The Third Department, reversing county court, held defendant's motion to vacate his conviction should not have been considered by the judge whose law clerk was the district attorney at the time of the defendant's conviction. The court wrote, "As one of the grounds raised in his Article 440 motion, defendant argued he was deprived of his right to appear before the grand jury due to the actions of the district attorney. The parties don't dispute that at the time that the defendant's Article 440 motion was decided, the judge's law clerk was the former district attorney who had prosecuted the defendant. Defendant contends that the judge should have recused himself from deciding the motion. We agree. Not only must judges actually be neutral, they must appear so. in view of the law clerk's direct involvement in defendant's case during her tenure as the district attorney and the allegations made in the Article 440 motion about her conduct while she was prosecuting him, as well as taking into account the need to maintain the appearance of impartiality, it was an improvident exercise of discretion for the judge to decide defendant's motion. So the takeaway here, the judge should not have decided defendant's motion to vacate his conviction because the judge's law clerk was the DA who prosecuted the defendant, and the defendant raised the actions of the DA as part of his motion to vacate the conviction. Next is People v. Rivera, pages 23 and 24. The issue raised on appeal was the bias of a juror, but the majority held that because that error or that issue was not preserved by an objection, they wouldn't hear the appeal, and there was a strong dissent. Third Department refused to consider whether county court properly handled an outburst by a juror during deliberations because the issue wasn't preserved. The dissenting justice would have considered the issue in the interest of justice and ordered a new trial. And this is from the dissent. The foreperson said it best. How did you get this far if that's the case? You shouldn't be here. The foreperson said this to one of the jurors, who was in seat number 6, after this juror revealed during deliberations that she was a victim of a rape, one of the crimes for which defendant was being tried. Juror number 6 had not disclosed this fact during voir dire or on the juror questionnaire. County court proceeded to question each juror, including juror number 6, to determine if any of them was grossly unqualified. That inquiry, however, was not probing and tactful, and consequently the court failed to ensure that the finding of guilt was the product of a fair and impartial jury. In my view, county court's inquiry did not meet the probing and tactful standard. Based on the allegations of rape made against defendant, juror number 6's revelation of being a rape victim, and the doubt expressed by the foreperson about juror number 6's impartiality, it was incumbent upon the court at the very least to ask juror number 6 about being a rape victim. The court intended on asking juror number 6 about being a sexual assault victim, but for some reason, it's not apparent in the record, it never did. Merely asking whether juror number 6 was a crime victim did not address the emotionally charged situation that the foreperson brought to the court's attention. The court's inquiry was therefore flawed from the outset. So the takeaway here, because the issue wasn't preserved for appeal by an objection, the majority refused to consider whether county court made a proper inquiry when a juror revealed during deliberations for the first time she was a rape victim, defendant was charged with rape, the dissenting judge would have considered the issue in the interest of justice and ordered a new trial. Next is People v. Coulter, pages 24 and 25. It's another juror-related appellate issue that was not considered because it wasn't preserved by an objection. Third Department refused to consider whether the court properly discharged the juror because the issue wasn't preserved. Two dissenting justices would have ordered a new trial in the interest of justice. And this is from the dissent. If a juror is unable to continue serving due to an illness, the court shall make a reasonably thorough inquiry concerning such illness and shall attempt to ascertain when such juror will be appearing in court. That's quoting Criminal Procedure Law, Section 270.35, Subdivision 2A. On the day at issue, and approximately 30 minutes after the scheduled start of the trial, county court noted that juror number 1 was not present. The court remarked she did leave sick yesterday, and after that remark said it was necessary to replace juror number 1 with an alternate. There was no reasonably thorough inquiry, let alone any inquiry, as to juror number 1's absence. Although juror number 1 was apparently ill on the day when she was selected for service, the court did not bother to learn if she continued to be ill. It seems that the court merely speculated that because juror number 1 was ill the day before, she continued to be ill, and that was the reason why she didn't show up at the scheduled time for the start of the trial. Such speculation does not meet the standard of conducting a reasonably thorough inquiry. Even if it could be said that the court did make a reasonably thorough inquiry, the court still failed to ascertain when juror number one would return to court. The record discloses that prior to discharging juror number one, the court neither heard from nor reached out to her to see if she would not be making it for the trial or if she was en route to the courthouse. So the takeaway here, the issue whether county court properly discharged a juror was not considered by the majority because the issue wasn't preserved by an objection. The two dissenters argued the court did not conduct a proper inquiry to determine why the juror had not appeared and whether the juror would appear. The dissenters would have considered the issue in the interest of justice and ordered a new trial. Next is People v. Harris, pages 25 and 26. Here the defendant's conviction was reversed because the jury instruction for the justification defense was inadequate. Third Department reversing defendant's manslaughter conviction in the interest of justice, that means the error was not preserved, held the jury instruction on the justification defense was flawed. The instructions didn't explain that if the justification defense was the basis for acquittal on the top count, which was murder, the jury must not consider the lesser counts. The court wrote, Supreme Court inadequately charged the jury regarding the justification defense. Although this issue is unpreserved, inasmuch as defendant failed to raise it during the charge conference and did not object to the final charge, we find it appropriate to exercise our interest of just jurisdiction to take corrective action and reverse the conviction. Where a defendant raises a claim of self-defense, the trial court commits reversible error if it fails to instruct the jury that if it finds defendant not guilty of a greater charge on the basis of justification, it is not to consider any lesser counts. This error was compounded by the verdict sheet, which directed the jury to consider manslaughter in the first degree if the jury found defendant not guilty of murder in the second degree. The verdict sheet did not contain a qualifier if the acquittal of murder was based on the defense of justification. Even though the jury may have acquitted on the top charge without relying on defendant's justification defense, it's nevertheless impossible to discern whether acquittal of the top count was based on the jury's finding of justification so as to mandate acquittal on the lesser count to which justification also applied. So the takeaway, if the justification defense is to be considered by the jury must be instructed to stop any further deliberations on any lesser counts if the justification defense is deemed to apply to the top count, and it also applies to the lesser counts. Here the issue wasn't preserved by objection to the jury instruction either at the charge conference or an objection to the final instruction, but the Third Department reversed in the interest of justice. Next is Matter of Francis O. It's a juvenile delinquency case that came out of family court, and the juvenile had made a motion to expunge all the DNA evidence that was collected from him, and family court denied the motion. The First Department, over a dissent, reversing family court, held appellant's motion to expunge all DNA evidence collected from him in the juvenile delinquency proceeding should have been granted. When appellant 16 was being interrogated by the police about a robbery, he was given a disposable cup from which he drank water. The cup was then sent by the interrogating officer for DNA analysis. No DNA had been collected from the robbery scene, so there was no investigatory purpose for collection of the juvenile's DNA. The court wrote, a juvenile delinquency adjudication, just as a youthful offender adjudication, is not a criminal conviction, and a juvenile delinquent should not be denominated a criminal by reason of that adjudication. A juvenile delinquent is not and should not be afforded fewer adjudication protections than a youthful offender or an adult in the equivalent circumstances. Family court has the discretion to order the expungement of appellant's DNA and any other documents related to the testing of his DNA sample. It has not been established that the juvenile purposefully divested himself of the cup or his DNA, thereby relinquishing his expectation of privacy. Nor has it been established that he waived, impliedly or explicitly, his constitutional rights to that expectation. DNA evidence obtained after an arrest should be material and relevant and should have a link to the charges for which the individual is arrested. There must be an articulable basis to obtain this DNA evidence and a correlation to the investigation or prosecution of the charged offense. That articulable basis to obtain the juvenile's DNA is lacking here. Under the totality of the circumstances, maintaining the juvenile's DNA profile in the database in perpetuity is completely incompatible with the statutory goal and would result in substantial injustice to the juvenile. So the takeaway here, the juvenile was 16 when he was interrogated by the police. He drank water from a paper cup. The interrogating officer sent the cup for DNA analysis. There was no investigative purpose for the DNA collection. The juvenile did not abandon the cup and did not waive his privacy interest in it. His constitutional rights were therefore violated by the collection of his DNA, and he was entitled to expungement of the DNA evidence. Next is matter of James J.J. on pages 28 and 29. It's another juvenile delinquency case out of family court. And it deals with the criteria for a dismissal in furtherance of justice, which is not only applicable in family court, it's applicable in criminal cases generally. The Third Department, reversing family court, held this juvenile delinquency proceeding should not have been dismissed in furtherance of justice. The juvenile was charged with acts of violence against the mother of his child. The court said, "Dismissal in the furtherance of justice is an extraordinary remedy that must be employed sparingly, only in those rare cases where there is a compelling factor which clearly demonstrates that prosecution would be an injustice. In determining such a motion, the statutory factors which must be considered are as follows. A. The seriousness and circumstances of the crime. B. The extent of harm caused by the crime. C. Any exceptionally serious misconduct of law enforcement personnel in the investigation and arrest of the respondent or in the presentment of the petition. D. The history, character, and condition of the respondent. E. The needs and best interest of the respondent. F. The need for protection of the community. And G. Any other relevant fact indicating that a finding would serve no useful purpose. At least one of these factors must be readily identifiable and sufficiently compelling to support the dismissal in furtherance of justice. According to the sworn statement of the victim, the mother of the respondent's child, the juvenile's child, respondent became verbally abusive toward her when she got pregnant and physically abusive after the child was born, including pinching, punching, and slapping her once when she was holding the child. On the date in question, the juvenile threw a full 8-ounce baby bottle at the victim, which hit her in the face, when she asked him to feed the child, who was crying. The victim stated that although she was bleeding heavily, the juvenile and his father discouraged her from seeking medical attention. When she eventually did go to the hospital the next day, a cut on her face was glued shut by a doctor, and she was told to return for x-rays after the swelling had gone down. The victim indicated that she felt unsafe living with the child in the home of the juvenile and his father. So the takeaway here, the allegations of violence in this juvenile delinquency proceeding were deemed too serious to warrant dismissal of the juvenile delinquency proceeding in furtherance of justice. This remedy should be used sparingly and at least one of the statutory factors for dismissal in furtherance of justice must be readily identifiable. At this point, I'm going to insert the third verification code for this April-May-June 2022 Criminal Law Update CLE. The third verification code is GRAND. Again, the third verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this April-May-June 2022 Criminal Law Update CLE is GRAND. Next is People v. Golding, pages 29 and 30. It discusses the permanently deprive element of larceny. Second Department, reversing larceny and possession of stolen property convictions, held the evidence that defendant intended to permanently deprive the owner of the U-Haul van of its property was insufficient. Defendant took a key to the van, sat in it for 2 minutes, and then got out of the van. The court wrote, in order to sustain a conviction for grand larceny, the people must show the defendant had the requisite larcenous intent, which means the intent to deprive another of property or appropriate the property to himself or a third party. The concepts of deprive and appropriate, which are essential to a definition of larcenous intent, connote a purpose to exert permanent or virtually permanent control over the property taken, or to cause permanent or virtually permanent loss to the owner of the possession and use of the property. For that reason, the mens rea element of larceny is simply not satisfied by an intent to temporarily use the property without the owner's permission. The evidence failed to establish beyond a reasonable doubt defendant intended to cause permanent or virtually permanent loss to the owner of the U-Haul van. A jury could rationally infer that the defendant intended to use the van temporarily. To prove grand larceny, the people had to do more than prove that the defendant intended to use the van temporarily. They had to prove that the defendant intended to permanently deprive the owner of his or her property, or to deprive the owner of it for so extended a period of time that a major portion of its economic value is lost. So the takeaway here, grand larceny includes the intent to permanently deprive the owner of the property. Here, defendant took a key to a U-Haul van, got in the van, sat for 2 minutes, and got out of the van. There was, therefore, no proof of an intent to permanently deprive the owner of its property. Because grand larceny wasn't proven, possession of stolen property was not proven as well. Next is People v. Abdullah. It's on pages 30 and 31. It's an unusual scenario where the defendant was questioned by the police while he was still in the sporting goods store after he had attempted to steal ammunition, and the court found that his Miranda rights were violated and they reversed his conviction. The Third Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that the questioning by the police when defendant was still in a sporting goods store where he allegedly attempted to steal ammunition constituted custodial interrogation in the absence of the Miranda warnings. The statements made by the defendant at the sporting goods store should have been suppressed. The court wrote, the entire transaction at the sporting goods store was captured by the various body cameras worn by the police involved. Viewing those videos, it is evident that throughout most of the interaction, four police officers were present at the sporting goods store, with at least one officer positioned between defendant and the exit. Shortly after the police arrived, defendant had been told to empty his pockets and place all of his personal property on the counter. Defendant did so. While being detained, defendant asked the police multiple times if he could retrieve his possessions. The police denied each of those requests. The questions posed by the police to defendant exceeded that necessary for investigation. Many of the inquiries were not limited to the petty larceny, the allegation in question, but focused on firearms that defendant may have possessed, their location, caliber, and defendant's intent as to the usage of the firearms. with the benefit of viewing the interaction between the police and defendant and considering all the circumstances involved, we cannot say that a reasonable person would have felt free to leave. So the takeaway here, defendant triggered a security alarm in a sporting goods store when he attempted to steal ammunition. He was detained by police in the store for half an hour and was asked questions about his possession of firearms. Because the questions exceeded the scope of the petty larceny investigation and were not preceded by the Miranda warnings, defendant's statements should have been suppressed and his conviction was reversed. Next is matter of McNair. It's on page 32, and it's a double jeopardy case. Fourth Department granted the defendant's petition for a writ of prohibition, barring retrial on the ground of double jeopardy. A jury was selected and three witnesses had testified when the trial judge became ill and scheduled a COVID test, which came back negative. The judge ultimately, sua sponte, declared a mistrial without defendant's consent. Because there were alternatives to a mistrial, a continuance, for example, the double jeopardy prohibition precluded retrial. The court wrote, there was no manifest necessity for the mistrial, and the court abused its discretion in granting it sua sponte. The record establishes the court did not consider the alternatives to a mistrial, such as a continuance or a substitution of another judge. If the judge acts so abruptly as to not permit consideration of the alternatives or otherwise acts irrationally or irresponsibly or solely for convenience of the court and jury, retrial will be barred. The court has the duty to consider alternatives to a mistrial and to obtain enough information so it's clear that a mistrial is actually necessary. So the takeaway here, the judge became ill after the trial had begun and declared a mistrial without the defendant's consent and without considering a continuance or the substitution of another judge. There was no manifest necessity for the mistrial. The double jeopardy prohibition therefore precluded retrial. Next is People v. DeJesus on page 33. It discusses the erroneous admission of Molyneux evidence to demonstrate intent where the evidence is not necessary to prove intent. Fourth Department, reversing the defendant's robbery and grand larceny convictions, held Molyneux evidence of a burglary of the robbery victim's home 3 days before the robbery should not have been admitted to show intent. The intent to rob was demonstrated by the victim's testimony, rendering proof of the prior burglary more prejudicial than probative. The court wrote, evidence that defendant may have been involved in an earlier burglary of the victim's home was not necessary for the jury to infer that 3 days later, defendant had the intent to rob the victim. Defendant's intent to forcibly steal property can be inferred from the victim's testimony that defendant, while wielding a baseball bat, directed him to comply with the demands of an unidentified masked gunman to turn over money and property. Under those circumstances, any probative value of the evidence of the prior burglary is outweighed by its potential for prejudice. For the same reason, defendant's intent to deprive another of property as required for a conviction of grand larceny or intent to place another person in reasonable fear of physical injury, serious physical injury, or death as required for a conviction of menacing could likewise be easily inferred from the victim's testimony describing defendant's conduct during the alleged crimes. So the takeaway here, evidence of defendant's commission of an uncharged crime, Molyneux evidence, to show defendant's intent to commit the charged offenses will be deemed too prejudicial if the intent element of the charged offenses is demonstrated by other evidence. Here it was demonstrated conclusively by the victim's testimony. Next is People v. Montzoros. It's on page 34. It's another Molyneux case. This time the uncharged crimes were admitted to prove a unique way of committing the crime called a unique modus operandi, which is evidence of the identity of the perpetrator. But the evidence was found not to meet the criteria for modus operandi evidence. The Fourth Department, reversing defendant's convictions and ordering a new trial, held the Molyneux evidence allowed by county court did not meet the modus operandi criteria. The court wrote, before trial, county court granted the people's motion seeking to introduce testimony. Defendant sexually abused his eldest son in the 1990s on the ground that the earlier uncharged conduct was admissible under the modus operandi exception to the Molyneux rule. Modus operandi evidence is a means of establishing the defendant's identity as the perpetrator. Here, even assuming arguendo, the defendant's identity as the person who committed the crimes was not conclusively established, we conclude that the similarities between the uncharged acts and the charged crimes were not sufficiently unique to make the evidence of the uncharged crimes probative of the fact that defendant committed them. So the takeaway here, if the identity of the perpetrator is an issue, and the manner in which the charged crime was committed is unique, evidence of defendant's commission of an uncharged crime involving the same unique modus operandi may be admissible under Molyneux. Here, sexual abuse allegations from the 1990s were not sufficiently similar to the charged offenses, and the uncharged evidence should not have been admitted. A new trial was ordered. Next is People v. Buckley on page 35. It deals with the effect of the prosecutor failing to address substantive allegations in a defendant's motion to vacate his or her conviction. The Third Department, reversing county court, held defendant had raised several substantive issues in the motion to vacate the conviction, which were not addressed by the people's response. Some of the issues were corroborated in an affidavit from defendant's prior attorney. Therefore, a hearing was required. The court wrote, we agree with defendant he's entitled to a hearing on whether counsel was ineffective in connection with defendant's alleged failure to fully cooperate under the terms of a 2016 cooperation agreement. A hearing is required on an Article 440 motion if the submissions show that the non-record facts sought to be established are material and would entitle the defendant to relief. In that regard, defendant averred that he consistently gave a truthful account of the burglary and had fully cooperated in the prosecution of a co-defendant as required by the cooperation agreement, and his motion papers included a 2016 supporting deposition from his sister and an affidavit from his former attorney to support those claims. Defendant alleged specific deficiencies in counsel's performance, namely that counsel failed to investigate whether the special prosecutor's withdrawal of the 2016 cooperation agreement was impermissibly premised on bad faith, invidiousness, and dishonesty. So the takeaway here, if a motion to vacate the conviction raises substantive issues which are corroborated in some way, here with an affidavit by defendant's prior attorney, and these substantive issues are not adequately dealt with in the people's responding papers, a hearing on the motion to vacate the conviction must be held. Next is People v. Backus on page 36. The issue is the avenues of appeal which are available to the prosecutor. Only those appellate issues that are delineated in the criminal procedure law allow an appeal by the people. The Third Department held the people could not appeal county courts granting defendant's motion to withdraw her plea, vacate her felony conviction, and allow her to plead to a misdemeanor. Defendant made the motion after she completed a drug court treatment program. The court wrote, it is well settled that no appeal lies from a determination made in a criminal proceeding unless specifically provided for by statute. Criminal Procedure Law 450.20 delineates the instances in which the people may appeal as of right to an intermediate appellate court. We find that county court's order resolved to be a post-sentence pre-judgment motion and no right to appeal lies under Criminal Procedure Law 450.20. we may not resort to interpretive contrivances to broaden the scope and application of this statute. As the legislature's policy is to limit appellate proliferation in criminal matters. Absent a specific statute granting the people the right to appeal, this court is without jurisdiction to hear the appeal. So the takeaway here, the people can only appeal on grounds described in the criminal procedure law. Here, county court granted defendant's motion to withdraw her plea, vacate her felony conviction, and allow her to plead to a misdemeanor. Her motion was made after she completed a drug court treatment program. The criminal procedure law does not give the people the authority to appeal county court's grant of the defendant's motion. Next is People v. Suleiman, page 37. The court found that the photo array was unduly suggestive and reversed the defendant's conviction. The First Department, reversing the conviction and ordering a new trial, held the photo array from which the victim identified defendant was unduly suggestive. The court wrote, "The hearing court should have granted defendant's motion to suppress the victim's identification of defendant in a photo array. The photo array was unduly suggestive because defendant was the only person shown wearing distinctive clothing which fit the description of the suspect. The distinctive clothing was an outstanding feature of the identifying witness's description of the robber. The victim told the police that he fixated on the unusual shirt the robber was wearing during the incident, a white shirt with a distinctive black design. In the photo array, the visible part of defendant's shirt closely matched the robber's shirt as described by the victim. The fillers, on the other hand, all wore shirts that, to the extent visible in the photos, were solid colored shirts without any markings or designs." So the takeaway here, the victim told the police the robber wore an unusual shirt with a black and white pattern. In the photo array from which the victim identified the defendant was the only one with a black and white patterned shirt. All the fillers had solid color shirts. The array was deemed unduly suggestive, and a new trial was ordered. Next is People v. Reese on page 38. It's another case where the plea colloquy was deemed to have negated an essential element, and therefore the guilty plea was invalid. Third Department, reversing the defendant's conviction by a guilty plea, held the defendant made statements during the plea allocution which negated elements of criminal possession of a weapon. At that point, the sentencing judge should have made an inquiry. This issue falls within an exception to the preservation requirement. The court wrote, "Penal law, section 265.03, subdivision 3, requires the possession of a loaded firearm, meaning an operable gun with either live ammunition in the gun or held on the defendant's person with the gun. Defendant negated that the element at sentencing when he stated that the handgun in question was in his bedstand drawer, not on his person, and that it wasn't loaded. At that point, it was incumbent upon county court to either conduct a further inquiry or give defendant an opportunity to withdraw the plea." So the takeaway here, when a defendant makes statements during the plea allocution which negate an element of the charged offense, the judge must make an inquiry or give the defendant the opportunity to withdraw the plea. The error need not be preserved for appeal. Next is People v. Marone, pages 38 and 39. It's another case where the plea colloquy negated an essential element of the crime. Here the crime was perjury. The Third Department, vacating the plea to perjury, held defendant's plea colloquy negated an essential element of the crime. The court wrote, "We conclude defendant is entitled to challenge the plea because he made statements during the colloquy that negated an essential element of the crime. A person is guilty of perjury when he or she swears falsely. A person swears falsely when he or she intentionally makes a false statement which he or she does not believe to be true under oath in a subscribed written instrument. An oath includes an affirmation and every other mode authorized by law of attesting to the truth of that which is stated. The document in question was captioned an affidavit of financial information. The preamble begins with the representation that defendant, being duly sworn, deposes and says the following under penalty of perjury. The following statement is included above the defendant's signature. I have carefully read the foregoing statements contained in this affidavit of financial information. They are true and correct. The document includes defendant's signature and a jurat completed by defendant's attorney. The same is true for the amended affidavit. During the plea allocution, defendant explained that he received the affidavit from his attorney by email, and then he filled it out on email as well and sent it right back to him. No statement was made that the attorney actually administered an oath to defendant before he signed the affidavits. Given defendant's limited explanation of the affidavit sequence, county court was obligated to further inquire as to the oath element before accepting the plea. So the takeaway here, the defendant's plea colloquy negated an essential element of the crime. The judge therefore should have inquired further before accepting the plea, and the plea was vacated. Next on page 40 is People v. Bovio. It's another case where the plea colloquy negated an element of the crime. We've already discussed this case in this CLE. The Fourth Department, vacating defendant's plea to depraved indifference murder, held the plea colloquy negated an essential element of the offense. We agree with defendant that although his admissions during the plea allocution established the mens rea element of recklessness, his recitation of the facts underlying the charge of murder in the second degree cast significant doubt upon his guilt insofar as it negated the second mens rea element of depraved indifference. In response to the court's question whether defendant did not care if harm happened to the victim or how the risk to the victim turned out, defendant stated through defense counsel that he did care for the victim. So the takeaway here, the defendant, during the plea colloquy for depraved indifference murder, said that he cared for the three-year-old victim. That statement negated the element of depraved indifference murder, which requires that the defendant not care if the victim lives or dies, and the plea was vacated. Next is People v. Robbins on page 41. It just stands for the proposition that when the judge sentences the defendant, the sentence must be pronounced for each count. Third Department, remitting the matter for resentencing, noted the sentencing judge didn't pronounce sentence separately for the two counts. The court wrote, "We're obliged to remit for resentencing. The sentencing transcript reflects that county court imposed a single sentence upon defendant and failed to pronounce sentence separately on each of the two counts of which she was convicted, as required by Criminal Procedure Law, Section 380.20. So again, a sentencing judge must pronounce a sentence separately for each conviction. Next is People v. Coleman, pages 41 and 42. It addresses the need to dismiss lesser included offenses. The Fourth Department reversed the robbery third and assault second convictions as lesser included offenses of robbery second. The court wrote, "Robbery in the third degree is a lesser included offense of robbery in the second degree. Although not raised by the parties, we note that assault in the second degree is a lesser included offense of robbery in the second degree. We therefore modify the judgment by reversing those parts convicting defendant of robbery in the third degree and assault in the second degree and dismissing counts 1 and 3 of the indictment." So the takeaway here, the robbery third and assault second convictions were reversed as lesser included offenses of robbery second. Next is People v. Williams, pages 42 and 43, and it deals with the judge's authority to limit self-representation by a defendant who is difficult to manage. The First Department held defendant who was representing himself at the time was not deprived of his right to be present at a material stage of the proceeding when the judge, outside defendant's presence, discussed whether defendant, who apparently was in an agitated state, should be examined by a psychiatrist. Ultimately, no examination was ordered. The First Department held the trial judge properly terminated defendant's self-representation based on his behavior during the trial. The decision addressed another unrelated issue, and the First Department found that a juror who apparently stated he did not wish to continue participating in the deliberations was not grossly unqualified. The court wrote, "The record supports a determination that defendant's conduct prevented the fair and orderly exposition of the issues and was disruptive to the proceedings. During the examination of the people's witnesses, defendant was repeatedly told by the court to calm down, to not get agitated, to not argue and be combative with the witnesses, and to not argue with the court regarding its rulings. The record also reflects instances where the court explained its rulings to defendant. Defendant stated he understood and would then immediately engage in the same conduct. During his testimony, the court repeatedly admonished defendant to stop making arguments to the jury. When asked twice by the court to sit down, he refused to do so. Defendant also repeatedly ignored the direction of the court officer to sit down. Instead, defendant remained standing, continued his argument, and questioned the court's ruling. Defendant also made reference to his over 1 year period of pretrial detention, as well as that he had a teenage son." So the takeaway here, the defendant's agitated behavior during the trial was a proper ground for terminating his self-representation, and the judge's discussion with counsel outside defendant's presence of defendant's mental health was not a material stage of the proceedings at which the defendant had a right to be present. And on that other unrelated issue, the judge properly refused to exclude a juror who during deliberations said he did not want to continue. Next is People v. Core on page 43. The issue is whether the 20-year period that a level one sex offender must be registered must start anew if a registered sex offender from another state moves to New York. The Second Department, in a matter of first impression, held that the 20-year duration of registration and verification of a level one sex offender starts anew when a sex offender registered in another state moves to New York. The court wrote, "The defendant contends that the 20-year period set forth in Correction Law Section 168-H, Subdivision 1, must be diminished by the period of time that he was registered as a sex offender in another state. We disagree and hold that the initial date of registration referred to in that statutory provision means the initial date of the offender's registration with the Division of Criminal Justice Services pursuant to New York Sex Offender Registration Act." So the takeaway here, a level one sex offender who was registered in another state before moving to New York does not get credit for the duration of the out-of-state registration. Next is People v. Galindo. It found that the amendment to the Speedy Trial Statute, which extends the statute's coverage to traffic infractions when they're jointly charged with crimes or violations, is not to be applied retroactively. The Court of Appeals held the amendment to the Speedy Trial Statute, that's Criminal Procedure Law 30.30 Subdivision 1E, which made the statutory time limits applicable to traffic infractions jointly charged with crimes or violations, should not be applied retroactively. The amendment went into effect while defendant's appeal to the appellate term was pending. The Court of Appeals held that the defendant's motion to dismiss the accusatory instrument, which jointly charged misdemeanors and traffic infractions on speedy trial grounds, should not have been granted by the appellate term. The court wrote, "Defendant was charged in 2014 in a single accusatory instrument with three misdemeanor counts and three traffic infractions under various sections of the vehicle and traffic law. Approximately 17 months later, defendant moved to dismiss the accusatory instrument on speedy trial grounds pursuant to CPL 30.30. The court denied the motion, concluding that the statute did not apply to jointly charged traffic infractions and that the people did not exceed the 90-day statutory time limit applicable to the misdemeanor counts. Thereafter, a jury convicted defendant of two misdemeanors and two infractions and acquitted him of the remaining counts. The appellate term granted defendant's motion to dismiss the accusatory instrument, including the traffic infractions, concluding that the people exceeded the statutory time limit to state their readiness for trial on the misdemeanor counts, and that the amendment applied retroactively. Because the amended statute was not in effect when the criminal action against defendant was commenced, CPL 30.30 subdivision 1E has no application to defendant's direct appeal from that judgment of conviction. So the takeaway here, the amendment to the speedy trial statute, which extended the statute's coverage to include traffic infractions jointly charged with crimes or violations, is not to be applied retroactively. Here the amendment became effective while defendant's appeal to the appellate term was pending. The appellate term should not have ruled the amendment applied to defendant's accusatory instrument, which jointly charged misdemeanors and traffic infractions. At this point, I'm going to insert the fourth verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this April-May-June 2022 Criminal Law Update CLE. The fourth verification code is FRISC. Again, the fourth verification code for this April-May-June 2022 Criminal Law Update CLE is FRISC. Next is People v. Hodge on pages 45 and 46. It's a vehicle stop case, and the issue was whether the police had reasonable suspicion that the defendant was armed such that they could frisk him. Fourth Department, dismissing the indictment over a two-justice dissent, held the police did not have a reasonable suspicion defendant was armed and therefore should not have attempted to frisk him when he got out of the vehicle. The fact that defendant threw his coat at the officer and ran did not justify defendant's arrest for obstructing governmental administration because the police conduct, that being the attempted frisk, was not authorized. Court wrote, the police proceeded to an attempted frisk by approaching the passenger side of the truck, opening the door, and directing defendant to exit the truck so that, as they informed defendant, they could perform a frisk of his person. The attempted frisk was unlawful because the record establishes that the police did not have knowledge of some fact or circumstance that supported a reasonable suspicion that defendant was armed or posed a threat to their safety. Even though defendant, despite being instructed to leave his coat in the truck, grabbed the coat, threw it onto one of the officers, and fled in the grassy area by the side of the interstate highway, the police lacked probable cause to arrest defendant for obstructing governmental administration, based on his alleged obstruction of the officer's attempted frisk, because that police conduct was not authorized. While the officers had also indicated to defendant they were going to perform a search of the truck, the people did not rely below on the theory that defendant was properly arrested for obstructing a lawful search of the truck, nor, as the dissent states, did the court explicitly base its decision on that theory. We conclude that as an appellate court, we may not uphold a police action on a theory not argued before the suppression court. So the takeaway here, the police didn't have a reasonable suspicion the defendant was armed, and they therefore should not have attempted to frisk him. The fact that the defendant threw his coat at an officer and ran did not provide probable cause for arrest because the police conduct attempting to frisk him was not authorized. The other issue here, an appellate court cannot consider a theory which would support the denial of suppression, but which was not raised below. Next is People v. Thorne, pages 46 and 47. It's a level 3 street stop case. The First Department, over a dissent, held the police didn't have reasonable suspicion defendant had committed a crime, and the level 3 stop of the defendant was therefore not justified. The suppression motion was granted and the indictment dismissed. The street stop was based upon a vague description of a robbery suspect which didn't match the defendant. The fact that the defendant acted suspiciously when the police followed him was not enough to validate the stop. The court wrote, the officers didn't have reasonable suspicion to conduct a level 3 forcible stop and detention by ordering defendant to put his hands against the wall, grabbing his arms, and forcing him to the ground. Defendant matched the description only in that he was a black male. that a defendant matches a vague general description, such as the one the complainant gave of the perpetrator, is insufficient to give rise to reasonable suspicion, particularly where, as here, key parts of the description do not match. Although defendant was walking at a fast pace and hiding his face from the officers, such equivocal behavior was just as susceptible to an innocent interpretation and may not increase the level of suspicion so as to justify a forcible stop. Walking at a quick pace is not considered flight. Defendant was under no obligation to walk more slowly or to show his face to the officers, since he had a right to be let alone and refused to respond to police inquiry. Defendant's desire not to make eye contact with the officers was equally consistent with an innocent desire as a black male to avoid interactions with the police. The police conducted a level 3 street stop based upon a vague description of a robbery suspect which the defendant didn't match. The stop was not justified by defendant's hiding his face and walking quickly when the police followed him. Next is People v. Ron Hill. The issue here was the validity or sufficiency of the misdemeanor complaint. It's a Court of Appeals case. Reversing the appellate term, dismissing the accusatory instrument, the Court of Appeals held the accusatory instrument did not allege that the synthetic cannabinoid defendant was charged with possessing was a controlled substance pursuant to the public health law. Defendant was charged with criminal possession of a controlled substance in the seventh degree for allegedly possessing an illegal synthetic cannabinoid. The public health law's controlled substance schedules criminalize possession of some, but not all, synthetic cannabinoids. Because the misdemeanor complaint to which defendant pleaded guilty failed to allege a sufficient factual basis to conclude that the substance defendant possessed was illegal, that count was facially deficient and should be dismissed. The public health law's statutory framework, which criminalizes only a subset of synthetic cannabinoids, renders it difficult for both the public and law enforcement alike to reasonably conclude whether a synthetic cannabinoid is a controlled substance without additional facts. Given this particular statutory framework, the misdemeanor count in this accusatory instrument contains a fundamental defect because it doesn't sufficiently allege that defendant committed a crime. The instrument's factual assertions gave no basis for concluding that the substance defendant possessed was a controlled substance, that is, an illegal synthetic cannabinoid, as listed with precision in Public Health Law Section 3306, Subdivision G, as opposed to one of the many synthetic cannabinoid substances that are not criminalized in the schedule. So the takeaway, there are many synthetic cannabinoids in addition to those designated controlled substances by the public health law. Here the misdemeanor complaint didn't allege enough facts to determine whether the synthetic cannabinoid allegedly possessed by the defendant was on the public health law list. The complaint was therefore facially deficient. Next is People v. Santiago on pages 49 and 50. The case addresses the criteria for a terroristic threat. The Third Department, reversing defendants making a terroristic threat conviction, held the conviction was against the weight of the evidence. Defendant's brother was incarcerated. Defendant was concerned that his brother was being harassed by corrections officers. Defendant allegedly called the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision and said he would blow an officer's head off if they touched my brother. The court wrote, a person is guilty of making a terroristic threat when, with intent to affect the conduct of a unit of government by murder, he or she threatens to commit a specified offense and thereby causes a reasonable expectation or fear of the imminent commission of such offense. Penal Law Article 490 was enacted following the September 11, 2001 attacks and was specifically designed to combat the evils of terrorism. The concept of terrorism has a unique meaning, and its implications risk being trivialized if the terminology is applied loosely in situations that do not match our collective understanding of what constitutes a terrorist threat. The evidence fails to establish the defendant caused a reasonable expectation of fear of the imminent commission of an offense under the factual circumstances presented here. Neither the first investigator nor the supervisor took any actions to warn the correctional facility or any other agency or individuals of the threat. While a notice was eventually issued, this was not done until well after the initial threat was made. None of the witnesses provided any testimony that they or anyone else had a reasonable expectation or fear that the threat would be imminently carried out, nor did their actions indicate any such belief. So the takeaway here, defendant's statement, he would blow an officer's head off if they touch my brother, did not cause the investigators who heard the statement to expect or fear the imminent commission of the offense, which is an element of making a terroristic threat. Defendant's conviction was therefore against the weight of the evidence, and the decision cautions against interpreting the terroristic threat statute too loosely. Next is People v. Fawcett on pages 50 and 51. It's another case dealing with the concept of criminal negligence in the context of a traffic accident. The Third Department reversing defendant's criminally negligent homicide conviction and dismissing the indictment, held defendant's failure to see the victim's vehicle on the side of the highway until it was too late did not rise to the level of criminal negligence, and the case was dismissed because there was legally insufficient evidence of criminally negligent homicide. The victim was in a pickup truck with a sign on the back warning drivers that road work was being done ahead. The court wrote, "A person is guilty of criminally negligent homicide when, with criminal negligence, he or she causes the death of another person. A defendant acts with criminal negligence in this context when the defendant fails to perceive a substantial and unjustifiable risk that death will result. That risk must be of such nature and degree that the failure to perceive it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. Criminal liability cannot be predicated on every act of carelessness resulting in death. The carelessness required for criminal negligence is appreciably more serious than that for ordinary civil negligence, and that carelessness must be such that its seriousness would be apparent to anyone who shares the community's general sense of right and wrong. As such, a defendant must engage in some blameworthy conduct creating or contributing to a substantial and unjustifiable risk of death. Importantly, non-perception of a risk, even if death results, is not enough. The Court of Appeals has held the unexplained failure of a driver to see the vehicle with which he or she subsequently collided does not, without more, support a conviction for the felony of criminally negligent homicide. So the takeaway, this case includes a detailed description of the criteria for criminal negligence. In the context of a traffic accident, the defendant's unexplained failure to see the other vehicle until it was too late, without more, does not constitute criminal negligence. Next is People v. King on page 51. It's the last case in the June criminal law reversal report. It deals with a seizure by blocking the defendant's vehicle. The Fourth Department, vacating defendant's plea and granting defendant's suppression motion, held the police did not have probable cause to seize defendant's vehicle by blocking its exit with the police vehicle. The court wrote, "Police officer testimony at the suppression hearing established that at the time the officers stopped their vehicle in front of defendant's vehicle, they had observed defendant's presence in a vehicle at about 1 p.m. in the parking lot of an apartment complex known for drug activity and where officers believed defendant did not reside, and they were aware that defendant had a history of drug-related convictions. Such evidence does not provide a reasonable suspicion that defendant had committed or was committing or was about to commit a crime." So the takeaway here, blocking the defendant's vehicle with a police vehicle is a seizure which requires probable cause to believe the defendant has committed or is committing a crime, and the evidence here did not rise to probable cause. That completes this April, May, June 2022 Criminal Law Update CLE.